listen to the Rogue Startups Podcast, where two startup founders are sharing lessons learned and pitfalls to avoid in their online businesses. And now, here's Dave and Craig.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the Rogue Startups Podcast. Today we have Price Intelligently pricing expert Patrick Campbell on the show, who is going to make us all feel great about our businesses and how we're pricing our products. So, Patrick, how you doing?
Doing well, man. Doing well. It's good seeing you. I know we got to hang out a little bit recently at the FemtoConf, and so it's good to be on here.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, it was a great time. FemtoConf is my second time there, and it was a great time. I just love these tiny conferences. I mean, Dave and I kind of rap on this a lot on the show, just that getting kind of out into the world with other people like ourselves is so healthy and so much fun, and we learn a lot. And your talk was the highlight of the conference from a lot of people's perspectives, because it really kind of brought out a lot of things that I certainly have never thought about, and talking to other attendees that we'd never thought about, and particularly kind of like the aspect of product or business validation from a pricing perspective. So not to jump in too much of it, but would you mind kind of giving the Cliff Notes version of kind of the ProfitWell story and how you guys kind of got into a relatively competitive market and took pricing into consideration as you were getting started?
Yeah, definitely. I think in just to kind of explain some background, so we've been around for about 5-6 years. We are a fully customer funded company, but we've grown, and we've been really blessed to grow. So we're about 40 people now. And it's something where we started off strictly with this piece of pricing software, which turned into what's called a tech-enabled service, which is basically software that we run for our customers. So you can't buy the software off the shelf, not even from an enterprise perspective. And we ended up, I think it's three and a half years ago, wanted to find something that was a little bit more scalable in terms of kind of proliferating across subscriptions and SaaS as a whole. And the idea kind of came out of a Price Intelligently customer. We were sitting with their board, and they were about to IPO, or at least were about to go on the roadshow. And we were helping them with their pricing, but we discovered that their MRR was being calculated completely incorrectly. And so that was kind of the spark of the idea. And we thought, oh, this is a problem that everyone has, you know, having accurate financial metrics. And what ended up happening is, we, you know, built a little MVP, and then we're about to launch. And quite literally, I think 3-4 weeks before we started pushing stuff out, Baremetrics had launched. And then I think 3-4 weeks after, ChartMogul launched. And it was one of those things where we weren't even doing our research externally. And we didn't even realize this until we started trying to do outreach when we launched. And people are like, oh, you're kind of like these guys, and you know, these other guys are launching. And so what you know, Craig was kind of getting at was, what we ended up doing is taking a step back and really, really just using pricing and our research around our customer and our product to kind of validate whether we should continue building the product or not. And I can go much deeper into it, but kind of the Cliff Notes version, or the TLDR, is what we discovered with, you know, 12 hours of research, not all at once, but over the course of a couple weeks, as well as spending, you know, a couple $1,000s just to get people to take our survey to kind of incentivize them, was that basically, you know, it wasn't a great market for us to actually sell the analytics. And there were much better opportunities for upselling if we used a freemium model by giving away the metrics for free and then upselling to some paid products. And that saved us probably about 18 months. And the data that we got from that actually was really, really validated, since a couple of our competitors either put their data public, Baremetrics, they publish everything. And our ARPU and LTV numbers were, you know, basically spot on to what theirs were at that time, our estimates. And then ChartMogul had come out with a free plan, I think it was a year or so after we had launched, basically because I believe some downward pressure. They very well could have made the decision on their own, but I think it definitely was something where we were getting nice and loud in the market. And so the big takeaway, not only, you know, collecting data to validate or invalidate ideas, but also kind of a really good example of a market where, you know, different folks can be successful with different aims. you know, we're pretty successful, or consider ourselves successful, and we give it away for free. I think Baremetrics has been pretty successful, and you know, they're, you know, obviously charging for it. And then Chartmogul has also been successful. So it's just kind of like, you know, different strokes for different folks, as they say.
You know, the thing I love about hearing this talk last weekend at FemtoConf was you mentioned that you wanted to pick a pricing model that would support the type of business that you wanted to grow. And I think there's certainly nothing wrong with building a lifestyle business. I think in a lot of ways that's kind of my goal, my personal goal. And so a pricing model that's maybe less scalable to the upside is okay for me. But for folks out there who want to you know, be able to take venture funding or build a $100 million business or something like that, you have to take the pricing model that you can apply to your business into consideration before you can even say, like, can I make this that big of a business? Because you're really kind of handcuffing yourself. I think that's a little bit of what you guys saw is if you just charge for metrics, you're only ever going to be able to charge whatever $99 a month. And that's a whole shit ton of customers, right, to get to be a really big business. But if you have an elastic type pricing model, just getting more customers in the long run means that customers end up paying you higher and they have a higher LTV kind of organically with the type of business that you're running. That really was kind of the huge aha moment for me. I mean, the validation was really important, but really kind of taking, like, beginning with the end in mind of the type of business that you want to build, and then making sure that the type of pricing structure that business can operate in allows for you to build that type of business. That was very like a light bulb moment for me. Yeah.
I think 100%, because I think a lot of us in this world, we just don't know thyself, you know. And this is actually, so at the beginning of the talk, I was like, I can give two, I have two talks. One's much more founder journey and, you know, still has some data. The other one's very, very data and has a little bit of founder journey, and everyone wanted to hear the data one. But what's interesting is the founder journey one, the whole message was exactly what you just said. So I'm glad it kind of came out in both, but it was kind of the know thyself, where a lot of us kid ourselves and think, oh, we're going to try to build a billion-dollar business, when in reality, we actually just want, you know, a million-dollar business or even a $50,000 business in order to you know, be happy. And then others of us, we, you know, get you know, almost the opposite, where we're, you know, I'm going to, you know, crap on, you know, this person who's trying to build a big business, when in reality, that's kind of their choice. And I just want to build, you know, a small business, if that makes sense. So I think that's where you can have, you know, if you know your numbers, you can kind of choose which direction you want. And for us, we do want to build a big business, and we want to keep that brand moving.
So I wanted to ask you a follow-up question on that, Patrick. So you had talked about how you initially got started, which sort of piqued up my interest, mainly because I hear this a lot from other founders that I'm talking to, and I know this is something that Craig and I have personally struggled with, especially early on. So you're familiar with Recapture, but when I bought it a year and some change ago, it was something where I didn't really understand the audience. I didn't really understand my customers. And you went in and you dove in for Price Intelligently here and ProfitWell to do all of these surveys up front. And you said that you actually incentivize them. So I have heard very polarizing comments about, should you do an incentive? Should you not do an incentive? And it sounds like you're very pro-incentive here, but you also got a lot of feedback. So can you talk a little bit about that process and kind of how you came about that decision to incentivize, and how many people you talked to and where you got them? Because I think that's kind of interesting to know how that sort of factored into the journey of ProfitWell.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we were very fortunate because the Price Intelligently software is survey-based. And so what we do on that side of the business is we help subscription companies get their pricing right. And we do that by collecting data from either customers that are current customers or target customers that may have never heard of you, and kind of everything in between. And so we were very blessed that by the time we started going after ProfitWell, we had basically spent a few years honing this craft of collecting the right data from somebody in order to get the right response. And I would say, to kind of cut to the chase, the biggest thing and kind of the answer to your question is that you have to know the limit of your data. And you also have to collect the right type of data for the answer or the magnitude of the question that you're asking. And so what I mean by that is we were trying to make a decision of, are we going to continue building this product or not? And we didn't need to answer with precision, you know, what the pricing model was supposed to be. We didn't have to answer with precision, you know, a lot of questions. We just needed to know, is this a market? So collecting, you know, baseline willingness to pay data, and, you know, we can get into how to actually do that, but collecting that type of data and then cross-referencing it just with the market size, that was going to give us enough of an answer to basically understand, should we continue building this or not, or at least if we're going to continue building this, what's the opportunity look like? And in terms of kind of incentivizing versus non-incentivizing, I think it's just a function of time typically. So a lot of people think incentivizing a survey is going to get you bad answers, and it's actually not the case. We've sent about 30 million surveys at this point, and I would say at least half of those have been incentivized, you know, through our customers. And what's been fascinating is most of the time the incentivizing basically just gets you the opportunity to collect more information. So with an incentivized survey, I can get, you know, 15 minutes of your time versus a non-incentivized survey, I can really only get, you know, a minute or two of your time if you're feeling generous. And so normally the responses and the answers are very much the same or with very, very slight variance. And so it's one of those things where it's more of a question of speed if you're going to incentivize versus, you know, non-incentivizing.
That's very interesting. Yeah. I've had a discussion with Heaton Shaw about this, and, you know, he's kind of come, well, I don't want to say he's come 180 on it, but I know that before he was kind of like, well, there's pluses and minuses to it. But now it sounds like he's very, don't do it because it totally taints the survey and people are answering that for the wrong reasons or whatever. But I'm glad to hear that your experience is actually the opposite of that, because I've tried both. I'm not anywhere near the 30 million, if I'm lucky in the 300, I think. But, you know, I have not seen tainting from the incentivized side, but I was always really concerned about that because I'm like, oh, well, Heaton's done this a lot. But now you're saying, no, I'm not seeing that at the 30 million. So I think I feel pretty good about your statistical significance there.
Yeah, totally. Well, I think you're going to get bad data either way. That's the thing to keep in mind. Like, especially when you're asking sensitive questions, you're going to have the person who for some reason thinks they're going to fool you by putting, you know, $0 down or something else for a particular question. And in reality, you're going to take those outliers out. You're going to kind of remix it and, you know, make sure that you're obviously cleaning the data. And yeah, I think Heaton's come around a bit. I think we've had some influence on that. We're actually, you know, working with Heaton in a couple of different ways. And if you follow his Product Habits blog, we're currently helping them with their current product in terms of pricing. And he's kind of him and his business partner Marie have just been putting everything public. And so it's been pretty cool to, you know, kind of get that out there in terms of, you know, the research and things like that.
Nice.
You mentioned a resource, Ask Your Target Market. Is that the website, askyourtargetmarket.com, where you can kind of pay to get these surveys put in front of the right people?
Yep, exactly. So it's AYTM.com, but if you search for Ask Your Target Market, I believe it redirects. There's also a company called Fulcrum in New Orleans that's a little bit they're a little bit more mid-market enterprise, meaning they have, I mean, there's all these companies out there where their entire goal is to get you in front of, you know, people to take surveys and do market research. And the self-serve one is AYTM.com, and you can get most people that most businesses need. When you start to get into heavier B2B, you probably need to use a Fulcrum.
Gotcha. So I know we wanted to play a little How's My Pricing? Dave, are you up for a little honest truth of what Patrick thinks of Recapture.io?
Oh, hell yeah. Bring it. No, I'm super excited. So Craig and I were kicking this idea around before the show. And, you know, when he said, oh, yeah, Patrick Campbell's coming on, I'm like, maybe I can get him to look at my pricing page. Yay! So yes, I would be very excited if you would take a moment and look at the pricing page that we have here for Recapture. So I'll throw out some background information on this. So like I said, I had acquired Recapture about, you know, 15 months ago or so. And pricing hasn't been like at the top of my lists to do, but let's just say it's in the top five things. And now that I've kind of nailed off a few of the top items on there and I have a little bit better handle on who my audience is and how they use the product and all that kind of stuff, pricing's kind of bumping to the top now, and I feel like I'm leaving a lot of money on the table, especially when I look at my competitors. So I would love to hear what you had to say about this, and then I've got some very specific questions if you don't touch on them. So go for it.
Let's do it. All right, so I'm going to check it out here. I'll do a little bit of a stream of consciousness, and I think I have a couple of questions just kind of right out of the gate while I'm looking at this. So automated abandoned cart recovery for Magento and Shopify, who's typically kind of your target buyer? What's their title? What size do they typically have in terms of kind of their GMV, that type of stuff? Like what's kind of that look like right now?
Sure. So there's a little bit of a split. I would say that there's two primary audiences that Recapture deals with. One is we deal directly with shop owners, and the shops themselves are anywhere between 500K to 2 million a year is pretty typical. Once they get above 2 million, I think they see that they need some different set of tools to really handle that volume. And below 500K, it's hard for them to extract a ton of value out of it because they just don't have enough traffic yet.
Mm-hmm.
They can get some. It's just not as much as the others. Like, that's the sweet spot, I think. And then the other part of the audience is like e-commerce developers, agencies, that sort of stuff, where they're actually building the site for their clients who are the shop owners, who aren't technical. And they, you know, they basically say, here's all the things that I want in my store. And then this agency puts it all together. They make some recommendations. And then they have sort of a list of trusted things that they want to put on a site because they know that there's stuff that they need to do on the site, you know, abandoned carts. Maybe they're going to have out of order notifications and, you know, you're going to miss out on this if you don't get this by this time, you know, checkout timers and stuff like that. So they've got sort of their favorites. But, you know, getting in front of those people, I've noticed, is also fairly important because the store owners immediately trust them over whatever they're going to find in the app stores.
Got it. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. And is there, does that change when you're looking at a Magento customer versus a Shopify customer?
I don't have a lot of data on Shopify customers yet because we literally haven't launched. We have launched. I don't have any Shopify customers yet because we're not public in the app store.
Got it. Okay.
So I'm guessing it's similar, but I don't really know that for sure. I know that the Shopify pricing kind of has a lot to do with the volume that the store is using. And there's sort of a general rule of thumb. If you're a Shopify store, the owners typically don't pay more per month for apps than they are already paying Shopify. So if they're like at a $29 a month plan, if you are trying to charge like $49 a month, they kind of hesitate because they're like, well, I'm only paying Shopify this much. So that becomes an anchor for them. But if they move up the scale, which is not hard to do once they get some volume, like $79 to $199 or whatever, then an app that costs, you know, $49 or something a month is literally a no-brainer for them.
Got it. And last kind of question here before kind of digging in. So on your pricing page, you have this line that says, on average, customers with this plan recover $1,500 to $3,000. If I go to someone on that plan and I say, hey, I just recovered $3,000 for you, how much of that do they attribute to you versus, oh, I was already going to get that money anyways?
We can actually directly attribute it to us, all of it.
Okay. They feel like if I went to that customer and said, hey, you're going to lose this $3,000 if you turn off Recapture, and they'll be like, oh gosh, we have to keep it on. Is that how they would react?
Oh, well, I haven't asked them that specific question in that specific way. So I don't know.
Got it.
I actually don't know the answer to that, but that's an excellent question.
Yeah. And the reason is because, so we have actually a pretty similar product. It's for a different problem. It's called Retain that helps with delinquent churn and soon to be active churn. And so the reason I was asking is because when you look at someone, especially in B2B pricing, but even in B2C sometimes, the value that we think we're providing does not always align with the value that the customer thinks is being provided. And we sometimes have this problem on the Price Intelligently side where we'll help someone with their pricing, they'll implement it, they'll see a very, very clear lift of, let's say, you know, $100,000 in MRR. Now, we go back to them and say, hey, we just increased your MRR by $100,000. And they go, well, we know you helped, but we also launched that marketing campaign and we also did this thing and we also did this other thing. And so there's like an attribution problem. And that's where I'm kind of asking, because I have some familiarity with kind of e-commerce platforms and different products that do abandoned cart. And oftentimes the problem is that someone will go, well, I was already going to get half of those abandoned carts anyways. So it doesn't really, you know, that $3,000 is wrong, right? And if that's, you know, not the case, then, you know, and I think overall your pricing is terribly too low. And I'm saying that as aggressively as possible so that you like change it. But I guess one other question, I know I said that was my last question, but, I'm assuming, you know, based on the podcast and, you know, some of the other things I know about you that, you know, you're trying to create a nice, healthy business, but you're not trying to acquire every Shopify store. You're going after more profitability and revenue versus, you know, acquisition. Is that a good way to say it?
Yeah, no, I'm not trying to swing for the fences here. I'm trying to have a good lifestyle business that basically meets my needs. And if it keeps growing beyond that, obviously I'm not going to stop it. But, you know, that totally is my primary goal. Yeah.
Well, the beauty here, and I'll just start, you know, kind of giving some pointers and some stream of consciousness and interrupt me if you want me to go deeper on something. But the beauty of what you're doing is that you actually have the ability to tie your value to revenue in some way. Oftentimes when, you know, we look at certain apps and, you know, I can, you know, talk about, you know, some of Craig's products as well, where I don't necessarily tie exactly what he's doing and some of his products to an actual piece of revenue. There's a number of different steps between, you know, a podcast or between, you know, some sort of workflow product or something like that, between that thing that's happening and revenue. And with your product on Recapture, it's basically, you can actually have, and I've seen your live demo, you can actually have a ticker that says, hey, this is, you know, this is the exact amount that I've recovered for you. We can argue about how much of that you would have already gotten, but this is something where, you know, I know that I've at least touched this revenue for you. And so I should get some credit for every dollar that's here. And so that's beautiful in the sense that you can start to back into how much revenue you could be charging without even doing some of these, you know, some of these surveys. And the natural kind of economist would look at this and say, well, if I brought you $3,000, you should want to pay me anything up to $2,999, right? Because I'm bringing you more money than you had, right?
It doesn't. But economists clearly are not paying for this tool.
Exactly. It doesn't work that way. And so when I look at your pricing, I think that I'm looking at the actual page right now. I think right now I have a bit of a value metric problem for you. And the value metric is what you charge for. And then what you're charging for right now is emails. So 2000 emails per month. And my issue with this is that I don't see the value in what you're doing is the number of emails that you're sending. The value of what you're doing is the amount of money that you recover for me. Now, again, I might not think that you recovered all every dollar or you deserve credit for every dollar, but I think that if you're going to give me $3,000 more per month, I feel reasonable that I might pay at least $300 for that per month, if not more, right? Because I can actually point to that money that I may have not have had before or that I wasn't going to bring in. And that's really where the value is. And so some of your competitors in the space, and there's a lot of folks who have done a lot of different things with recovery, they've basically, you know, they are charging based on the amount of kind of recovered revenue or abandoned revenue that's been brought back. And so I would push your value metric closer to that than emails, which is more of a functional thing. And especially if I'm a store owner that's doing less than 2 million, a lot of those store owners, they don't understand. They just don't understand a lot of things in a, you know, a good and bad way. And that'll allow them to kind of see like, oh, you're going to bring me $3,000 more and I'm only going to pay this. Great. That makes total sense. I got a couple of other things, but I'm just going to pause there. Does that make sense? Is that kind of grok with what you're thinking?
It actually totally groks with what I'm thinking. So I've looked across the other competitors and I've tried to figure out, well, what makes the most sense in terms of the metric by which I charge. And I'm one of the few that actually does it on usage as opposed to value. And so that right there was sort of like, maybe I want to reconsider that, because clearly I think that their MRR is directly impacted by that. If you can tie it to something where the customer is getting a lot of value out of it, then it's easier for you to charge more for it. Whereas where you're, like you're saying, 2,000 emails, well, if I can give you 10,000 emails, it only is twice as much. Okay, well, connecting that to something that they're thinking about or seeing on their bottom line is harder to connect. So I guess the only reason I didn't jump into this sooner was, aside from the fires that were burning slightly more brightly, was a fear of actually alienating customers from this. And I will be the first to tell you that's a totally rational fear. it's based on zero data, which should tell you right there that it's something that should be reconsidered immediately as a result. But I am definitely probably not the only person that has that kind of fear about touching the pricing lever, because you're always afraid that you're going to break something if you touch the pricing lever and do it the wrong way, right?
Yeah, I think it's, and I think that's one of those things to think about, which is a lot of us have this preconceived notion that is mainly based in fear that we can't talk about pricing. It's up there with religion, politics, and sex for some reason. And on top of it, we can't, you know, we can't change our prices, even though, especially in a B2B environment, people get that things cost money, right? Like, we all know things cost money, and if we're getting the value, we're going to pay for it. If we're not, then we're going to churn, or we're going to cancel the product. And I think that it's fascinating where, in your position, you actually have a nice sweet spot where you can actually increase your prices relative to where they are now to get yourself out of kind of the not so great customers who take up so much support and aren't really giving you any money, but then stay under the radar of the people who are, you know, going to cost a lot more support just because they're bigger and their expectations are much, much higher. You know, if you think of a product like Rejoiner, which has kind of gone more upmarket in this industry, those types of folks, you know, they need someone on a phone call, right? Like, you can't be on the ski slopes just hanging out, you know, and you know, having to worry about, you know, a call that's coming in. Whereas for you, even if you raised your prices 2, 3, 4x, you're still kind of in this interesting position where you don't really have to worry about things, and you're also obviously, you know, getting yourself closer and closer to that, you know, I'm really happy and I'm not working as much and it's a nice lifestyle business. So that's the first thing I would consider is getting in a little bit tied closer to cash. The alternative is if cash, you know, because not all cash is equal depending on the type of customer. You could also do based on number of customers that are recovered, but there's some kind of like value metric here that's a lot closer to the actual value that I'm getting as a customer. And you're already hinting at this on your website. And the one thing that you do that's really, really cool, in my opinion, and more people should do it, and you kind of do it as like subtext, and I think you should put this much, much upfront. Underneath each of the tiers here, you have, on average, customers with this plan recover between X and Y in lost revenue per month. That's kind of, you know, that value should be really up front and center so that I realize exactly what's going on. I'm gonna bring in, you know, an extra $15,000 this month if I use this product, right? And if you change your value metric a little bit, that jargon will have to change a bit. But I think that's really smart, and not enough people really kind of put the value prop in their tiers enough, which causes people a lot of confusion to kind of figure out which tier they really, you know, really end up in. And this will help you now, because instead of putting that, you might put, you know, best for businesses doing less than $2 million a year, or best for businesses that are doing, you know, $5 to $10 million per year in revenue. I think some other things that you do really well, and I'll get to some other pieces that I think you should fix. I think you separate out the overall plans from the many check marks. So basically, for those of you who are listening, up front he has the three plans with the dollar amounts, and then you have to scroll down past a CTA or two in order to get to all the features that are in the different tiers. And this is, you know, this is a smart way to do it, because you don't want to kill people with indecision by showing them a bunch of check marks. But I will say that once I get down to your check marks, I think that there are some pieces that I would kind of rethink. And this is kind of it's not a mistake, but it's just an optimization that I don't think a lot of people think about. And that's basically each of these tiers should correspond to a particular customer persona or a particular customer size. And you should separate out your features between the different tiers based on those particular personas that you're, you know, you're basically locking them into, or the outcome that you're trying to make. So I'll give you an example. When I look at something like multi-currency support, I don't know e-commerce, you know, buyers that extensively, but that feels like something that I'm only going to want if I'm more sophisticated. So I would take that out from being across the board to being maybe a more premium feature. When I look at something like a Zapier integration or any integrations as a whole, I look at that as something that's only going to boost the retention of my product. And so there's no reason I wouldn't want to include that in every single plan that exists, because it's going to just improve the overall retention and usage for the product that I have. And so I would basically look through each of these features and kind of rethink where they are in these tiers, and only kind of separate out the ones that are truly going to be for those premium customers, so that you kind of pull them up to those higher level tiers.
Nice, nice. Okay, so here's something you haven't touched on yet, and I'm going to throw this out there because it's something that I've seen a couple of my competitors do. So one of them has just a flat 3% across the board. You get all the features. The pricing is 3% of the revenue recovered. So that's one option for pricing. The other option that I see for pricing, and I've seen a couple of them doing this, there's kind of like a slider where they basically say how much revenue do you make a month? And as you drag it across, that revenue starts to change. And then at the same time, the price changes. But again, you get all the features in there. So they don't really segment on features. It's pretty much strictly on the value that's recovered at that point. So I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on either of those two right there based on your data and experience.
Yeah, I think overall, I really like the pricing where it is fairly inclusive, and the only difference between different tiers or different dollar amounts is the amount of value that you're providing. I think it's a pretty elegant solution, and you can still do some differentiation where, you know, that Salesforce integration that's only going to be for premium customers might be up in the enterprise plan, or that one feature that's, you know, premium support might be in the upper level plan. But I think that the second piece that you know is worth commenting on here is that your customer has to understand the value metric that you're providing in order, and also believe that you're providing that much value. So when I hear something like 3%, normally a small business, or a small business being defined as, you know, someone who's doing probably less than $10 million on an e-commerce store, and it's probably actually much higher than that. Those types of customers, understanding 3%, it starts to feel very nickel and dimey, where they're kind of like, well, I'm already paying Stripe this much percentage or Shopify this much percentage, and now all of a sudden I have to pay them 3% on this, even though it logically makes sense. If you sat them down in a room and you said, hey, I'm going to bring you this much money, it's only going to cost you this much, the percentage starts to feel like too nickel and dimed. And you see this in the market when you think about e-commerce platforms, where Demandware is really the only one who can get away with that. And the reason is because Demandware can clearly point to all the crazy stuff they're doing to actually build your business. So it's not just like this one thing that's kind of offset, but they're actually like, we're going to charge you 3% of your revenue because we're trying to bring you more customers. We're doing all this work for you, et cetera. And so I would just really make sure that the differentiation is justified, you know, overall, even if you're doing this type of pricing where you include all the features. But on top of that, you have to really make sure that value metric is believed by your customer in order to really justify it. And most of us don't understand or really agree with percentages.
Ah, that's very interesting. I had a visceral reaction to that pricing model myself, but I didn't quite understand why. So it's interesting that you kind of put some verbiage behind that and expressed other people's thoughts on it. Cause I think I was probably mentally doing the same thing, thinking, oh, well, there's a Stripe thing and there might be a Shopify thing. But it felt weird to me, and I just had a problem putting that on my own website. So I didn't just straight up copy them for that reason. And now I'm glad I didn't.
Yeah. You should never copy, just because that's always it's always problematic.
Yes.
Hey, Patrick, you talked about getting sort of into the mid-market a little bit. And Dave and I have actually talked about this a little bit in terms of our business strategies lately. In terms of pricing, and this is not to get away too much from Dave's example, but I think it is sort of pertinent. But at what point do you consider just straight kind of like entry-level pricing being kind of like getting into mid-market? And I ask because I feel like it changes, like you were talking about having to take sales calls and things like that for every customer. At what point should we think like, okay, like we're going to be charging too much, quote, to get customers relatively easily in like a self-service manner?
Yeah, it's a great question. And what's interesting is part of it is it does depend. It really does depend on kind of the market you're going after.
Sure.
You know, obviously, if you're going after, you know, luxury buyers, the luxury entry point is much lower. But and what's also interesting on the other end is that this number has been increasing. So it used to be, we're all similar age. You know, our parents or our parents' parents would never put a credit card online. You know, they will now, but in the early days, they were very scared to put a credit card online. They wouldn't purchase anything, you know, without maybe talking to someone, right? And now, like, we're so used to, you know, buying things online that I'm sure all of us have purchased, you know, a multi-$1,000 product without talking to someone, right? And so I would say that typically you're definitely, if you're under, you know, $300, you typically are going to see people that are more than willing to sign up, and you're not going to have to worry about that friction. Your volume might be lower. You know, obviously a $50 product is going to have a little bit more velocity than a $300 product. And then when you get between kind of $300 and $1,000, you'll certainly see, you know, people that do touchless, but you start to get to a point where some people do want to have a conversation. And so I would say that it starts to kind of turn. And then as you get over $1,000 per month, you'll still have to like talk to some folks, and some will still kind of want to sign up on their own, but a good portion of folks are going to expect to talk to a human and have some human contact, because you start getting into, you know, kind of the expectation game. And normally they do justify the contact. I mean, you can certainly say, you know, we're going to charge $5,000 a month and we're only going to do this with people who don't want to talk to us, but it's just going to be a lower volume.
Sure. Cool. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a great question though.
So
we have some data on this actually from because we did this study on freemium, where it was basically where we were trying to test what's like the friction from zero to blah, like what's the anchoring of zero, and it's gone off pretty significantly. So it's kind of like a proxy for this essentially.
Interesting. So thank you for all of the feedback on the pricing page there. I definitely have a lot of work to do on that. So kind of stepping back from my particular example for a second here, you know, with all the experience that you have on pricing pages and with general, you know, trepidation that I think everybody has either with their existing products and pricing or starting out with a new product and going, oh my God, I have no idea what to charge. What would you say is like the number one mistake that people keep making on their pricing pages or plans that you just like, you just want to reach out and throttle them for it?
And it can't be don't charge enough, because that's too easy.
Yeah, charge more. Yeah. That's Patio 11 shtick. You can't use that. Sorry.
Yeah, no. Yeah, Pesh. Yeah, that's McKenzie's. Yeah, he says that all the time. So I think, I mean... It's a little meta, but the thing that really bothers me and just frustrates the hell out of me is when most of the pricing advice you see is, well, you know what? We moved our highest plan from the right side of the page to the left side of the page, and that increased our ARPU by X percent. Or, hey, we A/B tested ending our prices in nines, and that increased this by this percent. Because those types of things are very tactical, and they're very they're very dependent on the product, and they're very dependent on the brand and all types of different things. And so I think the meta thing, or the more self-righteous thing, I should say, more than meta, is that I think people not spending any time on a continual basis on their pricing is what's really, really frustrating. And a lot more kind of tactical, I would say, is the fact that most people, they basically don't change their prices every 6 to 9 months, which is what they should be doing. And they get kind of romanticized into like, I can't touch my prices. So I would say one there is a little more theoretical, self-righteous, and the other is a little bit more tactical. I think it's, those are the things that are really frustrating because there's so much potential here and most of us just squander it by, you know, letting it kind of pass by, especially if you're a lifestyle business where, you know, you can afford to aggravate some people because you're not trying to get a million customers necessarily.
So, all right, you brought it up. Let me clarify that a little bit. What do you think is the ideal? You said every 6 to 9 months they should be revisiting their pricing. What should you do during that time? Like, I'm assuming you're not just suggesting that everybody go stare at their pricing page for 10 minutes and go, yep, all good. So there's probably some set of specific steps that you're thinking of in there. What does that look like every 6 to 9 months?
Yeah, totally. I think overall it's getting into a cycle of customer research. And this, if you want to talk about frustrations, I feel like I'm an old man because I feel like I'm going to gripe about a bunch of things, but I think, you know, overall, like this is a big thing where it's like, we aren't doing customer development. We aren't doing customer research. And normally in that 6 to 9 months, you should be doing a minimum amount of research. Like, hey, there's this one thing about pricing that I want to research. I'm going to do it for, you know, 20% of the time that I'm dedicating to this right now. And I'm just going to basically have, you know, some customer development happening in the background, because it's not only going to help your pricing, but it's going to help your product development, your product direction, your customer development in terms of who you're going after, your marketing development, all these different things. And it's that easy. It's just figuring out, okay, what's the one thing that I'm worried about? Let me go talk to some customers. Let me come back, make an educated guess based on, you know, the data that I've been given, and then, you know, put it out there to test it. That's something that you should be doing constantly. And the things that you should be changing are not necessarily raising your prices every 6 to 9 months, but adjusting your value metric, moving your features here and there, making an add-on versus, you know, including a feature. There's just so many different axes that, you know, can make this, you know, super useful.
You know, Patrick, one question that I had as we kind of look to wrap up here shortly is, you talked in your presentation this past weekend about something that is going to be facing me in the near future potentially is being maybe a little disruptive with the metric that we price on. And so ProfitWell was the first and maybe the only that I'll say has a freemium model for the analytics. Then you have add-on products and services that go along with that. Can you talk a little bit about how other businesses can think about approaching this kind of thing where they're going to say, okay, everyone else in the industry, podcast hosting, charges based on the amount of volume uploaded, right? Which is a silly thing from a business perspective. What if I want to charge based on the amount downloaded, or what if I want to have a flat or a freemium model? You guys did something kind of disruptive there, maybe even in hindsight. Kind of, can you talk about how you might approach that from a founder perspective and validating and rolling that out if you're going to have a totally different metric that you price on?
Yeah. So the question being, you know, if you want to change your value metric, like how do you validate that, or how do you change that up? Is that a good restatement?
Yeah.
I think it really comes down to, and we talked about this more specifically at the conference, but it really comes down to collecting data from those customers. And the way that I would do it is I would, you know, there's a logical set of value metrics that you could do, right? You could do downloads, you could do uploads, you could do hours, you could do, you know, by output. There's a bunch of different things that you could logically do. What I would want to do is take those five or those four, those three, whatever you think is logical, and get rid of the things that you think are just never going to work. And be honest with yourself. Like, if you think they could work, obviously include them. But for instance, if I'm a business, and for us, we just knew that we weren't going to charge based on the size of the company because we didn't think that that scaled correctly. So it didn't really matter even if the customers came back and said, hey, that's totally fine, that's what we want. We just weren't going to do it. We were going to find another way. And there's other things that you might be finding, which is, hey, we're just not going to do this because it puts too much of the success of the business on our customer, and we just don't control that. So that might be like number of downloads, for instance. So what I would say is I would take those 3 to 5 or however many there are, I would put up those particular pieces on a feature value or a relative preference survey. I would go out to them and I would say, your customers, your prospects, and I would say, when you think of X product, where do you see the most value and where do you see the least value? And then I would ask a similar question, which is, when you think of X product, which is your most preferred pricing, which is your least preferred pricing? And then it's just all those 3 or 4 or 5 different options. And then that's going to give you some data to at least see what your customers are thinking. And then you can also tie in some willingness to pay, you know, pricing, pricing data against that, and a whole host of things. But basically those two questions would allow you to start to figure out what your customers are thinking. And then you can figure out, okay, well, all of my customers think A, I think Z. There's going to be a huge shift for me to try to figure out how I can get them over to A, or I'm only going to care about the people who care about, you know, what I care about, if that makes sense. So that's kind of how I would go about doing it. And then when you're actually trying to make that change, you know, publicly, there's a whole host of stuff we've written that I can, you know, send over for the show notes about how to actually change your pricing amongst your customers. But it really comes down to just being really open and transparent and being very, you know, kind of clear and value driven with the communication.
Awesome. Yeah, that would be great. If you could shoot over some links, we'll definitely include those in the show notes. Yeah, that'd be great.
So aside from what you've talked about already, let's wrap up with this particular question here. What would you say is like the biggest win that most people can make right now to their own pricing?
Ooh, great question. The charge more. No, just kidding. That's already taken. Yeah. I would say the biggest, it's a little bit harder. But it is a really big win when you get it right, is get the right value metric. You know, right now, a lot of you are feature differentiated or your tiers are too far apart, but you got to be pricing based on a value metric. And the reason is because one, it helps tie your value to the revenue you're getting, but it also helps with expansion revenue very easily. Because obviously if someone's using more of that value metric, they should be paying you more essentially.
Nice. And if people want to reach out to you on the interwebs, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, you can just email me at pc@profitwell.com.
So profitwell.com is where you can find out more about that. And let me just gush publicly about Patrick's product here for just a second. So I've been using this for Recapture for probably the last year. I was using ChartMogul and they were okay. But when I got to ProfitWell, I felt like it was the set of metrics that I really wanted to see with the least amount of hassle to get me there. But at the same time, it also allowed me to drill in more deeply and get more detailed information out of things. So if you're a SaaS owner and you are looking for a way to track your MRR, it is very, very economic when you're getting started. Where I'm at in the MRR, it's on a free plan. But as you go up and you make more money and you get more successful, then there are paid tiers to go to, and they've got other products in there. So it also incorporates things like Dunning emails. And you said it does delinquent now, but you're going to do active here pretty soon. So yeah, I highly recommend ProfitWell myself, and we can talk about the sponsorship of the episode for this one later, Patrick.
Yeah, I was just going to say, where do I send the check now?
That's right.
I'll take it. Thank you.
It's true. You know, and to pile on a little bit there, Dave, I think that's something that is probably near and dear to both of our hearts that I see a lot with what you guys are doing, Patrick, is shipping features really regularly. And I think that just shows everyone who is, you know, a ProfitWell or a Retain customer that you guys are in this to add more value and continue to make our lives easier and our businesses better. And that is really appreciated. So thanks for everything you're doing. It's really awesome.
No, thank you guys. This is awesome. Yeah, I think it's you guys know how it is. It's a labor of love, and it's one of those things where you're always thinking about the bad things. So I appreciate the good things. Thanks for sharing.
Cool. Awesome.
No problem.
Thanks so much, Patrick. Appreciate it.
Absolutely, guys.
And if anybody else out there has questions that they want to ask about pricing or something that we can shoot over to Patrick or have a future discussion on, hit us up at podcast@roguestartups.com. And if you have 5 minutes, we'd love it if you could leave us a review on iTunes. The link will be in the show notes. Until next week.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Rogue Startups. If you haven't already, head over to iTunes and leave a rating and review for the show. For show notes from each episode and a few extra resources to help you along your journey, head over to roguestartups.com to learn more.